This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the catastrophe in Israel deepens. Is there any hope at all for long-term peace? Also, what Democratic majority? The New York Times says that today's young voters are likely to become conservative. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, the new PBS sitcom Vicious is about a 50-year-long gay relationship. Is it poignant and heartwarming, or campy and over the top? Then, David Brooks's 5 Steps for Becoming a Deeper Person. And then, the dystopian film Snowpiercer. It's both a $40 million action blockbuster and a seriously intended political allegory.
I am a hat. You are a shoe. I belong on the head. You belong on the foot. So it is.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories, already dire, worsened this week with rocket attacks from Hamas in Gaza and airstrikes from Israel. Peace has never seemed more remote. Is there anything the U.S. can or should do to calm the region? Then, Democrats have been crowing about their emerging majority, but the New York Times this week sprinkled cold water on the idea, arguing that economic trends may actually push millennial voters to the right, the way Franklin Roosevelt's presidency created a generation of Democrats. Is the Times onto something? I'm joined by Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon, who's in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
And John Dickerson is on vacation, so sitting in for him is The Atlantic's national correspondent, Jeffrey Goldberg. Welcome to the GabFest, Jeff. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
All right. The situation in Israel and the Gaza and the Palestinian territories is worse by the day.
That's brave.
Hamas is firing rockets into Israel from Gaza, including long-range rockets that can reach the northern populated cities. Israel has been launching airstrikes in Gaza, apparently killed some dozens of people, and may be preparing for another ground invasion. The Israelis and the Palestinians both seem full of fear and hatred and anger, disappointment. Israelis about the horrifying kidnapping and murder of 3 Israeli teens a few weeks ago, and then the terror of Hamas's rocket attacks. Palestinians about the apparent retaliatory murder of a Palestinian teenager, the Israeli airstrikes, the settlement expansion, and the just continued immiseration of Palestinians. So, Jeff, you have been covering this issue with rare subtlety. Is there anything different in the dynamic between Israel and Palestinians over the past few weeks that change? I mean, it's already been a kind of despairing situation. Is anything different that should make us despair more?
More than the usual.
More than the usual
despair.
Yeah.
Well, what should make us despair more than the usual despair is that the rest of the Middle East is even worse. And what's interesting about this week is that we've stopped talking completely about the Middle East. We just passed the 170,000 death mark in Syria. No one seems to care about that at the moment because this is going on. In the Israeli-Palestinian context, hatred just gets more deeply embedded every time there's a death or a rocket or, you know, anytime your children get their house blown up or your children have to spend the night living in a bomb shelter. It just embeds this more deeply. It is proof, if nothing else, that Hamas is an illogical organization. And if nothing else, it proves that the status quo is not sustainable. But this is the third round of this Gaza-Israel war, and they have the same features. You know, it will end. And then it'll happen again. And that's maybe the most depressing part.
Right. There's this phrase, mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
Which is the idea that there's the...
It's a cop phrase, actually. It's an American cop phrase.
So what
does it
mean?
Which you go into a neighborhood, you arrest the drug dealers, and, you know, and they come out, and you got to mow the lawn again, put them back in jail. It's the same thing in Gaza now. I think some Israeli general used it. It's basically, you know, you go in, you destroy as many rocket launchers as possible, and then you know that in a year from now, you're going to have to mow again. Different. This is one thing that's different, is that now, as much as Israel hates Hamas, Egypt, which controls Gaza's southern border, hates Hamas even more. The government of Egypt is radically opposed to Hamas. And so Hamas is in a bad position anyway, because it's not going to have an easy time getting rockets in the same way that it was during the Morsi period or before that, during the period of chaos. So I'm sort of amazed that they're spending as many rockets as they are, which suggests either they're completely foolish or that they have more rockets than people thought.
I think of this as the hourglass where the sand is running out because of the shifting demographic picture, where there are going to be soon more or close to as many Palestinians and Arabs as Jewish Israelis, if you include the West Bank in thinking about Greater Israel. And that seems to me that it's not exerting the intense, urgent pressure on Bibi Netanyahu's government as I always want it to. Is that because it's just not immediate enough, given all the violence and the hatred that takes precedence?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Gaza's a little bit of a separate piece of it, because
yes,
Gaza's not going to be absorbed into Israel. With any luck, it'll be part of an independent, standalone Palestinian state. It might be absorbed into Egypt in some sort of future scenario that we can't imagine.
Lucky Egypt.
Yeah, you know, nobody wants it. But on the general point, yeah, I mean, your point is interesting because it goes back to what I was just saying about the status quo being unsustainable. Part of the reason the status quo is unsustainable is that the demographics are slowly shifting. I mean, it's not as dramatic as next year or the year after. But, you know, there's this belief on the part of the right in Israel that you could just kind of maintain this and Israel will be fine and the Palestinians will get used to it. And it's just not. I don't think that's true. This doesn't feel very status quo like. This feels pretty bad. I mean, it's the Middle East, so it could always be worse, obviously. But
that's the tourism motto, you know.
What? No, I would say, though, certainly for Iraq right now, you know, we're not Syria, and Syria could have "We're not Iraq" as a tourism motto. But yeah, I mean, I think you're onto something. And the frustrating part, I think, the frustrating part for me is that I'm convinced, based on personal experience and talking to him, that Netanyahu knows that this is an actual problem. That either pathway isn't good. You can't keep him, but you can't let him go. Is sort of where he is. And my argument is that if you allow the West Bank and possibly Gaza to become independent, you might have a terrible security problem on your hands in future years. If you don't, you're definitely going to have a problem in future years. So it's a choice between two, you know, really unpalatable scenarios.
Right. So if Israel keeps the territories, mm-hmm, and allows, which it will never do, allows Palestinians to become citizens. It no longer is a Jewish state.
Is the haven for the Jewish, the one Jewish state in the world, the haven for the Jewish people, et cetera.
If it keeps the territories and doesn't allow Palestinians to become citizens, it becomes an apartheid state.
Right. Or like a permanent Jim Crow or whatever you want, a limited autonomy or some, you know, nonsense that's not really sustainable in the international system.
Do you think that the U.S. has any role to play right now?
Yeah, and U.S. can keep things from getting worse. The same role it has in other parts of the Middle East. You know, try to ameliorate, try to you know, suspend.
Seems to be working in
Iraq. No, I mean, no, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting. You know, here's a situation in which the U.S. is Israel's closest ally for any number of reasons. The U.S. gives the Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and it can't get either party to do what it wants. So then you hear people are saying, well, what we need to do is get more deeply involved in trying to get the Shia and Sunni in Iraq to get along. And you're like, really? You know, people who already hate us are going to listen to our prescriptions. So it's sort of like, on the other hand, yeah, I think when the U.S. withdraws from these problems, the problems tend to get worse. So having active diplomacy is pretty useful. And at a certain point, the U.S. is going to tell Israel, okay, that's enough of this round of the war. And they're going to get Turkey and Qatar to tell Hamas, okay, chill out with the rockets. And then we'll go back to the status quo for a while, and then this will happen again.
Jeff, do you have any sympathy for the boycott, divestments, and sanctions movement? The argument that I've been thinking about lately, which I'm confused by, is that most of the time when you have terrible behavior by a state, you have an authoritarian regime. And so if you boycott, you know, academics or companies, it's not necessarily going to make any difference. But Israel is a very vibrant democracy in which Netanyahu, whoever else is in charge, is responsive to public opinion. And so the argument for this movement, which I hesitate to make because the idea of boycotting anything in Israel is, I'm kind of allergic to it. But the argument is that you put pressure on the voters, on the people who can influence public opinion, and that it could actually sway Israel in the direction, toward feeling a more urgent sense.
How do you
that
know Israelis don't feel an urgent sense? How do you know that?
I think some of them do, but I don't think it's controlling the outcome enough right now.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they're the ones who are realistic about the state of the Middle East, though, and we're not being realistic sitting 6,000 miles away. I mean, maybe they're the ones saying, you want me to give up territory now? And we've seen when we give up territory, it's filled by Al-Qaeda. No, thank you. But going to your point, I'm completely allergic to this because boycotts have traditionally been a weapon used against Jews, obviously, most notoriously in World War II, but going back, you know, obviously, centuries. So I'm allergic to it. I mean, there's a legitimate debate, you know, obviously in American foreign policy circles. What does Israel respond to? Does Israel respond better to incentives and a close embrace, like a hug, or does it respond to pressure? I had an interesting conversation once with Hillary Clinton about this, and Hillary says, and I think this is probably correct, that Israelis will take bold leaps if you're holding their hand. Like if you want to tell Israel to jump off a cliff, grab their hand, go with them. When you pressure Israel, the national tendency is to kind of go up Masada, you know, and say, thanks, but, you know, we understand our history better than you do, and this is not going to end well, and so we're just going to get...
So that also involves jumping off a cliff, I will just...
They didn't jump.
See, here's the thing.
Jumping.
It's the Middle East.
Some
everything,
of them jumped.
Everything ends with a cliff. Everything ends
right.
with a cliff.
I guess that's the problem.
Coming up, are young voters becoming more Republican? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and Jeffrey Goldberg, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. In a story for the New York Times Upshot section this week, the always delightful David Leonhardt makes a tentative case that today's young people, millennials and those a bit younger, may not be the reliable Democratic voters that Democrats have been counting on. Leonhardt's basic claim is that voters are strongly shaped by the political and economic environment of their teen and young adult years, and that the weak economy and the fights about Obamacare and various other things, and the general sense that government can't get anything done, will push these youngsters away from the Democrats and presumably, therefore, towards the Republicans, that Obama essentially will be held responsible for the sluggish economic growth and the inequality of the past 15 years. We're not here to debate the question about whether it is reasonable to hold Obama responsible for these things, which it is not, but whether, in fact, this political swing will happen. So, Emily, we have been hearing...
You really narrowed the terms here.
We're not talking about the substance. We're just talking about, like, is this a real phenomenon? Are the millennials going to be driven away from the Democratic Party because the economy is just in the toilet and has
been? So, I found this argument really implausible because there's so many other factors that are pushing the millennials toward the Democrats. There's the increasing number of Latinos who are going to be in the country who, unless things change, break like 70% Democratic, I think. There's the social issues that Democrats win on with this age group in particular, like gay marriage and legalizing marijuana. And also millennials poll high in a way that's heartwarming to me, for broad-based government intervention, for the idea that you're supposed to fight inequality and other evils with social programs put in place by the government. And the Republican Party right now is so very much against all of the things I just named, but that one in particular. And I also feel like most people hold Obama somewhat responsible, but get that it was also factors beyond his control in the Bush administration and that the recession in a lot of ways preceded him and he was left to pick up the pieces. Isn't that something that we've absorbed as a country?
Let me speak on behalf of the country when I say yes.
Please.
And no.
Is this Israel you're speaking on behalf of?
No, I'm speaking on behalf of Palestine at this point. No, I thought David told us not to talk about whether it's true or not, so I'm trying to follow your arcane rules.
Yeah, he was really authoritarian.
Yeah, no, I know. He really was. When I read this piece, and I love David, when I read this piece, I kind of wish that he didn't write it so tentatively. I mean, if you're going to go for a leap, go make the leap. And there were so many caveats in it that I thought he probably doesn't really believe this. I would have liked to seen more on this. I think Emily's exactly right. Unless the real variable is whether the Republican Party changes, I think, not whether millennials blame Obama for stagnation. If the Republican Party no longer seems anti-immigrant, no longer seems opposed to gay marriage, no longer seems to pot legalization and all these other things that you mentioned, then there could be a pronounced shift. If the Senate goes Republican and then we have the next years of a Congress in which both houses are controlled by Republicans, maybe that's ultimately good for the Democrats because people will blame them. People will blame the Republicans for whatever stagnation they see.
I have a different take than you guys, which is that the Republican Party clearly is not a credible alternative and they're not presenting any vision. The basic project of the conservative movement, and particularly parts of it in the last decade or so, has been to strongly discredit the idea of government being effective at anything at all. Mm. And they've got plenty of good evidence, and they've acted to make government less effective and to slow things down and grind gears. And it's a project that has made people, I think, much more skeptical about government generally. If you look at the polling, people are more skeptical that government can do things. They don't believe in government. That is a recipe for moving people away from the Democratic Party, all kinds of voters, including young voters, away from the Democratic Party because they look and they don't see a government that gets things done. Therefore, they are less engaged with the project of Democrats, which is generally to get government to do better things. That doesn't mean they become Republicans, but it does mean that they are less Democratic. And I think those are two different points. And to me, what's alarming is not – I don't see all these young voters – going out and becoming Ted Cruz acolytes and getting all enthusiastic behind that. There's, you know, that's going to be a small minority. What I do see is a large, highly disaffected group of young people who will be facing poor economy, poor economic prospects, tons of debt, who will be vulnerable to some other form of sweeping populist movement, something which is not necessarily what either the Democrats or the Republicans are offering right now. And that's kind of scary.
If you get nihilistic about the government and its ability to change the social conditions you're talking about, then what have you got? I mean, this is where I think conservatives, I mean, a few of them have some decent ideas about this, right? But not the ones in power. And so if that happened and we had that kind of populism, David, I feel like it would be a more lefty version of it, which could be a good thing from my point of view.
It might be. I just feel like it's uncertain. I feel like one reason we're entering a very treacherous political time is that neither party seems to offer solutions.
I think what you're saying to David Leonhardt is expand the parameters of what you're writing about, because there might be something wholly new coming down the road that's not the usual bifurcation. I'm just sitting here trying to figure out what John Dickerson would say, and then I'm going to try to say it. But
John Dickerson would have like six polls.
He would cross his arms and look thoughtful and then have something very thoughtful to say.
Dickersonian poll point to make.
Dickersonian.
Which is that the polls,
that's a great
yes,
word.
That's a word. The polls about millennials show that they actually do think that the government can make social change, and they want to give the government
authority. Is that because they're just young and because young people are optimistic?
Right. Isn't that right?
I think so.
But you're arguing that they're going to immediately lose that as they age, and that's the end of them.
I'm sure relative to older people, the millennials believe government can make change more than our generation does. But relative to what our generation believed 20 years ago or what our parents' generation believed 40 years ago, I bet they're lower. I bet their millennial confidence in government is lower than Gen X's or the
oh, absolutely.
I don't think that's necessarily true. Can someone please, some dear listener who knows the answer to this question, because I know you're out there, write in and prove David and Jeff wrong?
What do you guys feel? How do you guys feel? This is a totally separate point, but we're all of the Gen X. We're all in our 40s. We had a really great run as Gen X from like 1992 until three years ago, people paid attention to us. They cared. We've now been surpassed. Like the millennials, they're a bigger generation. They're so Instagrammy, and they are Snapchatting. They're right now. They're all just Snapchatting our podcast.
And they're the new thing. Who cares about us?
But right. So how do you guys feel that now that we've
they still want us to pay for them? Surpassed. That's the thing.
They have a lot of college loan issues. How do I feel bad? Who wants to get old and turned into chopped liver?
Well, first of all, chopped liver is delicious. Second of all, I mean,
I don't want to be eaten.
This is as inevitable as the tides or whatever else is inevitable. First of all, I don't think we're that irrelevant. Am I deluding myself? You're looking at me.
David
is looking at me like I'm deluding myself.
Well, it's not like I do. You know, there's still whatever 50 million of us or something, and we'll sell Depends to them and Metamucil.
We have to keep
them,
working because otherwise the economy is really going to fall apart.
So apparently, we should be a generation that is quite Republican because we grew up, we hit our prime in the Republican heyday in Reagan, Bush. Do you guys feel that we are part of a conservative generation? I feel like temperamentally, I think we are.
I think we live in particular ghettos.
Yeah, what would we know? We live on the coast.
I don't know if that's something you could ask us. Yeah, we live on just one coast.
Exactly.
But you don't. I feel like people of our cohort are, in fact, not conservative in how they vote in the worlds that we run in, but they're actually more prudish and are more.
How
kind of
are you wildly generalizing? Like, based on what? That's
he doesn't
such
like
a
Instagram.
Large
I think he
statement.
Doesn't like people
like
who use
you
Instagram.
Rode the subway with some Gen Xers the other day.
I mean, I think we're parents, and so you know when you're parenting obviously leads you to certain conservative conclusions about the way the world is organized, and it's a little bit mysterious and off-putting when your children come home with new inventions and new ways of communicating that you didn't hear about. But I mean, I don't think that makes us conservative.
All right, here's the one data point I would use. The one data point I use is that I believe our cohort.
I shamed him into a data point.
Our cohort is the lowest drug using cohort. We used drugs way less than people who were before us and people came after us.
And we
were
eat a
reacting
lot more
to the crack
food.
Epidemic.
You know, the last time I saw David Leonhardt was 3 days ago in a Whole Foods. How's that for a data point?
Yeah.
That's an awesome
What was he doing?
He was shopping for...
buying conservative
foods
at Whole
Foods?
No, he was
buying lettuces, different exotic
that
lettuces.
That is wholly unsurprising.
Holy. That was good.
Holy.
That was good.
Anyway.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, the movie Snowpiercer. It's both a $40 million action blockbuster and a seriously intended political allegory. Can it find an audience as significant as its message, not to mention its budget? Then Ian McKellen and Derek Jacobi star as an elderly gay couple in the British TV import Vicious. And finally, the pundit David Brooks tells us we should all strive to be deep. Joining me today is Slate culture critic and editor of Outward, June Thomas. Hey, June.
Hey, Stephen.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right, well, digging in. Snowpiercer is a South Korean-American joint production blockbuster action film, oh boy, based on a French graphic novel. It's directed by Bong Joon-ho, director of The Host and Mother. This is his English language debut. Oh, and what a debut. To combat global warming, scientists released a chemical into the atmosphere that sunk the planet into a perpetual winter, the only survivors of which are aboard a massive train which loops the globe once every year. The supposed dregs of society are huddled in the rear of the train. The well-to-do live up front in affluent splendor. As pretty much everyone has noticed, this is a timely political allegory about the global 1%. It stars Chris Evans, known to American audiences as Captain America, and Song Kang-ho, who is pretty much the coolest man who ever lived, and from the evidence of this movie at least, and Tilda Swinton, who's magnificent. Why don't we listen to a clip?
In the beginning, order was prescribed by your ticket. First class, economy, and frail orders like you. Eternal order is prescribed by the sacred engine. All things flow from the sacred engine. All things in their place. All passengers in their section. All water flowing, all heat rising pays homage to the sacred engine. In its own particular, preordained position. So it is. Now, as in the beginning, I belong to the front. You belong to the tail. Know your place. Keep your place.
All right, well, Dana, the obvious place to start here is with you, the Slate film critic. What did you think of this movie?
Well, I think it succeeds very, very well on the level of a summer adventure movie, and I had tons of fun in it and appreciated that it also brought a lot of, as you say, political allegory and thoughtfulness to the table. I don't know that I think it's quite the masterpiece that some critics have thought it was, maybe because I was expecting so much, because this director, Bong Joon-ho, is just, you know, one of those sort of global rarities who makes a different, completely different and brilliant movie every time he makes a movie. So for him to make his first English language movie and kind of international release that is seen outside of art houses was very exciting to me. And I'm not quite sure, especially when it comes to the end, which we won't spoil, but hopefully we can talk about obliquely somehow. I don't think this movie quite lived up to the sights that it set for itself. And I know June really disliked it, so I'm curious to hear her.
Oh, no, I didn't dislike the movie, but I did I both admired greatly and absolutely hated with a huge burning passion Tilda Swinton's little bit, her Yorkshire bit. But I kind of love the movie.
Really? Okay, so the thing that you were expressing loathing about is Tilda only. Can you take a little bit of time to explain that? And we should also maybe explain a little about her character.
Right. Well, so her character is kind of, I guess, the rule follower. She's somebody who lives in the front of the train, so that's the posh bit. And she comes back to the sort of grumbling, rebellious tail end to kind of just remind them of their place. She's the woman who just believes completely in the rules. I think in another version of this story, she would probably be a vicar or a priest or something, you know. So she's that person. And we know that Tilda Swinton is an amazing beauty. In this film, she's kind of made to be very plain, quite unattractive. She's also given some horrible false teeth, which are also flawed. And worst of all, she speaks with this northern accent, which northern English accent, which I love that Bong Joon-ho introduces humor into his action films, and I think that's fantastic. I wish more people would do it. But why do we have to have a plain northern woman with bad teeth be this figure of humor? And I also don't know really where it comes from, except maybe Tilda Swinton, because I can't believe a South Korean and Kelly Masterson, who's an American from New Jersey, would want to do some British, you know, anti-northern thing. I know you said...
Can I respond? Can we go down the road of Tilda Swinton's accent? Because I happen to know something about that, because the screening I saw of Snowpiercer had Bong Joon-ho and Kelly Masterson, not Tilda Swinton, unfortunately, but John Hurt, not the Korean star, but someone else who was in the movie. Anyway, a nice little panel from the movie. And they told a story that Tilda Swinton told on set. Apparently, Bong's sets are these very, you know, Robert Altman-like sort of improvisatory places, which is crazy when you consider that what they're making is this highly choreographed summer blockbuster. But he very much encourages people to go down their own creative road and follow their own process and come up with their characters. And so she thought of the way that character would look and costumed her and based the Yorkshire accent on her nanny, her nurse, from when she was a little girl who she loathed.
Right.
So this villain she imagined was essentially her bad mother kind of projected onto herself.
Right. And I heard that in your spoiler special, the great spoiler special that Dana did with Forrest Whitman about this movie.
Fun to discuss.
But I still hate it with a passion because I just think that humor, I mean, I know you shouldn't try to sort of, you know, you shouldn't police humor, but I hate when humor goes down, when it points down instead of pointing up. And especially in a film like this that's about, you know, income inequality and social inequality and lack of social mobility, that the person that you make fun of is somebody who in the real world, northern, plain northern women with bad teeth really don't have any power in the world.
And gosh, she was such a comic grotesque to me that it's funny she didn't invoke a social type. But of course, as a Brit, she
would. As a northern woman with bad teeth, perhaps also maybe just ever so slightly, you know, close to the bone, it set me off.
What about you, Steve? You haven't reacted to the movie yet.
I liked the movie. Let's start with Tilda Swinton's performance and the teeth and the accent. I wasn't able to, like June is able to class specify it, but what made me uncomfortable about it is a remarkable performance. It's a tour de force. But what made me uncomfortable about it was how much sadism it inspired in the other characters in the movie who totally credibly and totally justifiably hate her. I was dismayed by how much sadism it inspired in me. I mean, I just wanted this person's head on a spike. And, you know, quite a lot of the energy of the movie, I mean, it's unusual for that aspect, most unusual for that aspect. It is a completely unmistakable, totally pointed political allegory about the 1% and the 99%, especially in a global context. You know, the most interesting thing about the movie is when they finally, and this is to absolutely blow no surprises, but when they finally bust up further along the train, they start to go through the various worlds that each car on the train represents. And you feel as though you're breaking through successive levels of, you know, income quintiles globally, right? I mean, in a way, this is the movie we keep asking for, which is just to inject some degree of consciousness and thought into these action blockbusters. But Dana, I'm curious, did we, you know, be careful what you wish for? Is it almost packed to the gills with this, you know, allegorical meaning?
I mean, it is certainly a packed cornucopia of a movie, right? It's full of ideas. It's full of images. We haven't talked much about the look and sound of the movie, but it is incredibly visually, what would you call it? Stimulating, lush. You know, it provides many different environments, as Steve was saying, and incredible opportunities for production design. I think the problem for me was not the overstuffedness. I enjoyed the experience of being smitten, smoted by this movie. But something about the allegory at the end, I'm not actually sure what this movie is trying to say about revolution. And it very clearly is sort of a Marxist revolution that it imagines, right? And then at the end, without giving anything away, there's kind of a bifurcation of goals on behalf of this group of rebels that's moving to the front of the train. What kind of revolution do they want to effect, right? Sort of on the order of, you know, are we overturning the social order? Are we maintaining it? Are we creating a new one?
Or are we just ending it all?
Or just, yeah, or are we just going to nihilistically kind of go off the rails? And those are very compelling and important questions to ask, worth mentioning also in the context of the environment, because this is also a very pointed allegory about man's destruction of his own environment. And I'm not sure at the end that the movie quite knows whether how blockbustery it wants to be in the answering of those questions and how much pessimism and optimism it wants to balance. And I can't say more without giving too much away.
Yeah, it seems like it wants to stimulate dorm room discussions, but not actually kind of tell us what it thinks. You know, it's an engine, you know, it doesn't necessarily have a point of view, even though it suggests that we should think about these things and talk about these things. But I don't know that it really has a particular conclusion.
Okay, well, the movie is Snowpiercer. It stars Chris Evans and Tilda Swinton. It is definitely getting tongues wagging. You should go see it and tell us what you thought of it at facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, British import sitcom Vicious about an old gay couple is campy, it's catty, but is it funny? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf along with Dana Stevens and June Thomas, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, guess what? We collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, while you're there, if you would, leave a comment, tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next topic. Vicious feels like a BBC comedy of the old school, though I should add quickly, it's not actually BBC, it's ITV. Anyhow, it has the comforting rhythm of an old BBC comedy of setup, punchline, with booming canned laughter and a lot of put-down humor. Except the sniping couple at the center of it is gay. Ian McKellen and Derek Jacobi star as Freddie and Stuart, who have been together for 50 years. Why don't we listen to a clip?
So who were you squawking at on the phone just now?
What, my mother, if you must know.
Was she calling to tell you when she'd be dying?
She was very distraught.
Why, did you finally tell her about us?
I'm waiting for the right time.
It's been 48 years.
And there has not been a right time. No, please don't pressure me. I'm very emotional already. We've had some frightful news. Clive is dead.
Oh. Your mother is always the first to know when someone dies. Is she getting the news directly from Satan?
June, the show has inspired a wide range of reaction, as you would expect it might. On the one hand, it's a very loving portrayal of pre-post-closet gay men, those who dared to marry even before it was legally sanctioned by the state. On the other hand, you know, some people have said this is a pretty stereotypical bitter old queen act that McKellen and Jacobi are doing. Where do you fall on this? What do you make of the show?
I adore this show. I love that finally we're hearing from bitter old queens. I feel like I know who these guys are. I know guys like these men. I find that particularly performative style of cutting each other at every opportunity, of just being vicious with each other, to be very believable, to be quite funny. And you're right, Steve, that this reminded me very much of some old British sitcoms. And at the same time, it also reminded me, in a way, showed me how much of that style of humor actually owes so much to that kind of, you know, very gay kind of very nasty, apparently nasty, actually very loving banter. It also is just amazing that we have a show that's basically about really pretty very old people, people in their 70s, maybe their late 60s, with one young man who is in many ways the least interesting person. You know, he's the outsider who's maybe trying to break into this group. It's
basically
just fantastic.
He kind of exists as a representative of younger hot men to be sort of desired by both the male and female characters.
Right.
I mean, I think I would find this structure boring after a few shows through, but I enjoyed it for the wonderful timing and repartee between these two actors who really kind of play it like big, like a stage play. You know, it does feel like a filmed play, but in kind of a pleasing way. And also just because of the extreme cynicism of its view of family life. I mean, the shows that it reminded me of in terms of its kind of moral genealogy were absolutely fabulous, and Married with Children in a Strange Way, you know, which both have that kind of, that very campy, almost commedia dell'arte quality of everyone embodying their stereotypes so thoroughly that they kind of transcend it.
Yeah, I mean, there is, it's funny because you mentioned that repetition. I mean, I think that it is quite a repetitive show. It's a formula show, which you can either see as, you know, a negative or a positive. And I kind of found it quite, you know, Dadaistic or something. You know, the fact that almost every show, or maybe every show, begins with Stuart having a conversation with his mother, the joke being that he's not out to his mother. Now, I found those conversations among the least funny things in the show. I mean, the show is a series, you know, 22 minutes of, as everybody said, setup, joke, laugh, setup, joke, laugh. They were not funny jokes. And yet, just the constant presence of this sort of guy in his 70s avoiding coming out to his mother just became, you know, the runningness of the joke became.
My favorite running joke in that sense is about their dog.
Yes.
Barclay? What's the dog's
name?
Balthazar. Balthazar, that's right. So they have this 20-year-old dog that sleeps in the kitchen at all times, who is just played by a lump under a blanket. And this is a great, just old couples, gay or no, right? Just the joke of the old pet. And they're constantly poking him with a broomstick to see if he's dead yet. Do they have to start mourning, or is he still a living hunk of material?
Exactly. Yeah, all the things about hold him up while he uses the bathroom. Yeah, I absolutely adore Balthazar.
Well, I should say I love everything about the show except it. You know, I love Jacoby and I love McKellen. I love that it's about, you know, older people without condescending to them in the least. I mean, how could you get McKellen and Jacoby to play, you know, reductive stereotypes? You couldn't. And even if you handed them scripts that reduce their character to stereotypes, they would transcend that. And in this instance, they do. They're wonderful. I love that it's about a gay couple. I love that it spans from the closet to post-closet. I love the politics of it. I just don't like it. I just don't like it. It just reminded me of shows that my parents would put on Friday night on PBS, these really canned British sitcoms.
Are You Being Served?
Yeah, and from three rooms over, you could hear kind of the wah-wah of the dialogue and then the boom, you know, the booming follow-up of completely pre-recorded laughter. And, you know, Dana, you mentioned Ab Fab, Absolutely Fabulous, which is among my favorite, if not my favorite, British import comedy of all time. And there was, and that followed that formula too, but it was just the cynicism and the wit and the acidity of it, where it was flavored so unusually and so originally that I was surprised at how little this show reminded me of Ab Fab. But anyway, I'm thrilled that it exists. I suspect I won't watch it again.
It's really interesting to me how much this is a very gay production. The creator, Gary Jannetty, he kind of took over the idea from Mark Ravenhill, who is a wonderful British playwright who just kind of couldn't take it up because he's busy with the RSC. You know, the music is by Jimmy Somerville. As we've said, the main actors, McKellen and Jacoby, are out gay men. To me, that's one of the most exciting things about it, because I do, you know, I feel like I know these people. I feel like they've been created from, you know, gay characters. And it is interesting, as you said, Stephen, that there has been a real, there's very little middle ground. A lot of people either seem to love it or hate it. In the New York Times, Gary Jannetty compared the response to the show to the response to Marmite, the British spread that people either love or detest. And I know that a lot of the people who didn't like it are out gay men who I think are kind of finding it a little too close to the bone or something. I think the fact that it's kind of about queenie men, it's you know, there's a little bit of femme phobia in some of the negative reaction, I think. But I really recognize those characters and that kind of humor. And I also like that there's love in it, too.
All right. Well, check out the show. It's called Vicious. It's on PBS. See if you respond to it. And if you do one way or another and you got something to say, come tell us at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, well, moving on. We plan for happiness but are formed by suffering. So David Brooks told an audience at the Aspen Ideas Festival recently, expanding on a column he had written last March. Let me quote from the column a little bit. He said, quote, "When we say that someone is a deep person, we mean they have achieved a quiet, dependable mind by being rooted in something spiritual and permanent." And he went on to say, "A person of deep character has certain qualities. In the realm of intellect, she has permanent convictions about fundamental things. In the realm of emotions, she has a web of unconditional loves. In the realm of action, she has permanent commitments to transcendent projects that cannot be completed in a single lifetime," closed quote. David Brooks has started talking about depth in what presumes to be a serious way. Dana, presumably we're all in basic accord accord with what David Brooks is saying. It's better to be deep than shallow. But isn't the first thing that you do if you want to be deep is to not go to anything called an ideas festival?
Yeah, well, when we said that we were going to talk about this topic, as soon as I heard David Brooks' name, I thought, why are we doing that topic? But to my surprise, this has actually turned into something I do want to talk about. Maybe not so much focusing on, you know, David Brooks and this thing, this idea that he's working on about depth, but maybe just somehow the paradoxical imbalance of what we're talking about. Is it possible to sort of issue moral teachings from the pulpit of the Aspen Ideas Festival or the TED Talk or even the New York Times op-ed page? It's funny. It's as if David Brooks, who I think of as sort of a political, social commentator in general on the op-ed page, seems to be wanting to occupy more the space of a teacher, which actually is something that he does, right? He teaches a class at Yale, I think, in exactly this, how to be deep with David Brooks sort of thing. So, yeah, initially, I guess my thought would be this is a shallow guide to how to be deep. And if you really want to learn how to be deep, go read the Bible or some great literature, or, you know, like dig into some spiritual traditions instead of listening to David Brooks boil it down for you. But to my surprise, when I actually watched the talk that he gave at the festival, I found it somewhat impressive as a rhetorical performance, much, much better than it works on the page, for sure. And it made me realize that he's probably a pretty lively college professor, that we might not be his audience because we already sort of value ideas, I think, as, you know, members of this talking community. But he was talking about teaching students at Yale, very, very bright and competitive students who are ready for the global marketplace and who have been trained since birth by his sort of fantasy of the tiger mother. You know, this is all part of his bohemian bourgeoisie satire shtick that he's been doing for a dozen years or something. That's all kind of recognizable. But when he sits down and gives the lecture that he sort of gives to his college students, I thought, I wouldn't mind my kid taking a class in, you know, St. Augustine and the stuff that he's talking about. They were great texts he was reading. So I don't know. I guess I'm on the fence about this. I feel like if David Brooks wants to run along and address the children of the bohemian bourgeoisie about how to be deep, I would rather have him doing that than opining about income inequality on the op-ed page.
Hmm. But June, hasn't this always been the balancing act for David Brooks, that there's something quite obviously engaging and charming about him and personable? But when you lay his ideas out on the page, like, you know, pin them up like little dead butterflies and examine them dispassionately, they're significantly less charming than the presentation, than the messenger.
Yeah, I always have this feeling with David Brooks. It's what he doesn't say, you know, that he very artfully, I think, suggests conservative ideas, while at the same time, knowing his audience, which, you know, presumably the New York Times core audience is much more liberal than he is. And so he kind of, you know, he doesn't lecture you about conservative ideas. He just kind of sneaks them in. And I always kind of feel them just kind of on the edge of the page, you know, trying to get at me, or that he's kind of dog whistling or something. And in this lecture, which I actually read because my internet is terrible, and so I read it, which I think was probably a slightly different experience, because some of his jokes, which I knew were jokes because the transcript said laughter.
It's like the vicious laughter.
Exactly. That, you know, I just couldn't stop noticing what he wasn't saying. You know, he's sort of talking about the importance of love and the, you know, that we should be less focused on the kinds of success that this big bogeyman that he conjures in this very aggressive way that I kind of hated, the tiger mother, you know, who has this style of success that these young Yaleys are, you know, are about to launch into. And so he sort of contrasts that with, you know, the life of the spirit or something. But it doesn't talk about politics. He didn't talk about kind of why the American sort of the American way of individualism, you know, denigrates the communal experience. That everything that, frankly, I find a little troubling about America and challenging, the fact that we really don't share things like healthcare, that we don't, you know, that the tiger mother is all about getting her kid into Yale, which means that your kid won't. We're not really trying to elevate everyone. We're trying to, you know, help our own families, help ourselves. And I just kind of wish that he would have addressed that whole notion of, you know what, maybe if we weren't just trying to, you know, prioritize our own success, and if we're trying to help everyone and raise all the boats, we might be a better society. And so,
well, I feel like he would subscribe to that in the abstract, but as soon as that started to be about, you know, I don't know, means testing or something, you know, he might change his tune.
Right, which is exactly, I think, what David Brooks, you know, is to me the thing that makes me crazy about him, that he sneaks by an idea that I actually think, Brooks, you might be onto something.
And then he Trojan horses in some kind of big social policy.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, June, I thought that was beautifully said. So I want to start out somewhat unpredictably being positive about it. On the plus side, I take him at his word when he says that this isn't self-help. You know, the trick to self-help is to enumerate something that appears to be a completely non-instrumental value or value system, and then kind of turn it and make it suddenly instrumental. So you tell people to be mindful or contemplative or, you know, Buddhist or on and on and on. And then you kind of flip it and switch it, and that shows them how to be a better middle manager or entrepreneur. It doesn't seem to me he's doing the flip. He's not setting this up for the flip so that you can, you know, instrumentalize or operationalize this language of depth in such a way that you'll be a better knowledge worker. And I admire that. I'm glad that he doesn't appear to be doing that. I also like the fact that especially in the original column, it's avowedly anti-evolutionary and sociobiological, by which I don't mean, and Brooks doesn't mean, that we're not, you know, biologically rooted creatures. We are, and we're derived from natural selection. We are. Only, as Brooks says, this is not and cannot be a comprehensive explanation for who we ultimately are, which I'm glad. I'm glad to see someone who's otherwise culturally and politically conservative admit that Darwinism isn't a fully explanatory belief system for who we are and what we want. Here's what I don't like about it. The great British philosopher Gilbert Ryle wrote a great book called The Theory of Mind, or Concept of Mind, I think is actually what it's called. And in it, he has this wonderful aside in which he says, the vain man does not think he is vain. And what Ryle is getting at is that our self-descriptions are almost by definition at odds with who we are, that what we say about ourselves is almost always inevitably false. And in fact, all of literature, all of the literature of depth that David Brooks is fancily and fancifully alluding to, derives from the fact that speech acts are at odds with actual actions. That's where we get comedy, and that's also where we get tragedy from. So, they're the group of descriptors that I always think act as prima facie evidence that the person using them to describe themselves isn't that. And I would say that you can't really call yourself witty, and you certainly can't call yourself modest. To that, I would add deep. You just can't call yourself deep without sounding like its opposite, just sounding like a completely shallow
like Stuart
twit.
Smalley.
Absolutely. And the final thing I'll add is that, you know, for at least 30 years now, people have been wondering what the boomers are going to sound like as they start to age. And we're getting a taste of it now. And, you know, this is among other things, this is an anti-youth culture screed. It's a senior culture screed. It's a plea for taking people who have accumulated selfhood over long stretches of time and therefore have a certain depth or gravitas or wisdom. It's a plea to take them more seriously than Miley Cyrus et al. And, you know, right on time, here they come. I mean, the boomers are starting to hit their 60s. They're starting to retire in great waves. And we're going to hear more of this. We're going to hear more about how the culture of shallowness that the boomers foisted on all of us. All right. Well, those of our listeners who still want to check out the original column that Brooks wrote called The Deepest Self back in March 2014, it's on the New York Times website. We'll link to it. And then there was a recap of his Aspen Ideas Festival speech in the Atlantic Monthly, David Brooks's Five-Step Guide to Being Deep, a manifesto against America's happiness and resume cultures. We'll link to that as well. All right. Well, now is the moment in our program where we endorse. Dana Stevens, what do you have?
Well, Steve, I'm going to go you one better with the local endorsements that sometimes drive our listeners crazy, where you have to get ice cream at one place in Vermont and you have to get pizza at one place in Woodstock, New York. So I'm going to take us even farther afield for our global listeners and endorse a tour guide in Guanajuato, Mexico, who I met this past week when I was on vacation in Mexico with my family. So I feel like this guy really deserves the plug because it was without a doubt the most enriching cultural experience I had last week while on vacation. So the guy's name is Albert Coffey. So if you're ever in Guanajuato, Mexico, a state in central Mexico, and you want to learn something about one of the most interesting Mesoamerican sites in the world right now because they're still in the process of discovering stuff every day, then go to coyotecanyonadventures.com and look up Albert Coffey and have him take you on a tour of the Cañada de la Virgen pyramid in Mexico.
June, what do you have?
I want to endorse a really lovely novel called These Things Happen. It's by Richard Kramer, who's a longtime TV writer. He was worked on 30-something, among other great shows. And this is a novel based in New York. And to me, it's kind of a, not a post-gay novel, because we're not post-gay, but it's kind of what happens after we just kind of, we stop hating and we say that we fully embrace gay people and gay family members. And when something happens, and that's kind of challenged, and we, you know, as they say on Real World, what happens when people stop being polite and get real? It's a very wonderful evocation of New York. It's beautifully written. It's funny. And it also just has very interesting ideas. So These Things Happen by Richard Kramer.
Righty. All right. Well, we had previously, I think it wasn't last show, maybe a couple shows ago, we were talking about Paul Simon and lesser-known Paul Simon albums and tracks. And I've always been a huge fan of Hearts and Bones. I think it's the album that he came out with right before Graceland. And in fact, I think Hearts and Bones is his least and may still be his least successful studio album. And on it is a song called Renee and Georgette Magritte with Their Dog After the War. The pretentious title aside, it is such a sweet little ditty. And it has this amazing conceit. I wonder if it's based in fact at all, which is that, you know, you get these little vignettes of Renee and Georgette Magritte, who I assume emigrated to the United States during the war, as many, many artists did, many surrealist artists most famously did, Max Ernst among them. But anyway, they're in the United States and they're sort of marveling at the affluence and the ease of their lives. And then when they get alone, they dance to these old, I guess, kind of 1940s or 1950s doo-wop or rock bands, which Paul Simon then enumerates one by one, the Penguins, the Moon Glows, on and on and on and on. And it's just one of those utterly magic moments in a song where the narrative of the song, the melody of the song, the lyrics of the song, the rhythm of the words, the whole thing really comes together. And there's something about this surrealist artist and his wife dancing to these paradigmatically American rock and roll acts. It's exquisite. It's a great song. Check it out. All righty. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
June, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gapfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate GabFest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Max Tanney and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.
Renee and Georgia Magritte with their dog after the war. Return to their hotel suite.